Well, I think 1969 makes Apollo 11 all that more marvelous, spectacular. 1968's a really bad year for the United States. By February of 1968, it's pretty apparent that something's gone horribly wrong in Vietnam. Lyndon Johnson, a political force of nature, has decided he's not going to seek another term as president. Within a couple of days, Martin Luther King's assassinated, and then within a couple of weeks, Bobby Kennedy is killed as well. Every spring, every fall, the college campuses explode in anti-war protests, and by this time, rioting. And every summer, the nation's inner cities explode in the worst race rioting in American history. 1969 is Richard Nixon's first year. The nation is more divided than it has been since the Civil War. And so then that summer, you have what is maybe one of the crowning achievements of humankind. We finally land on the moon. As Kennedy had insisted that we send a man to the moon, bring him back safely by the end of the decade, which at the time in 1961, when John Kennedy had made that call, the sheer audacity of that had been, I think, stunning to most people. And then to actually do that, an incredibly crowning achievement.
What was the force and the leadership like then, not only from Kennedy, to be able to set that in motion to get that done by the end of the decade, but also from, I guess, the follow-up from Johnson, and did Nixon play a role in it straight away from that time that he was in office?
Sure, and all of this is within the context of the Cold War. The Cold War establishes really the parameters for everything that happens in the country politically, economically, socially. And certainly the Apollo missions are no different. After the Soviets had launched Sputnik in October of 1957 and then had launched Yuri Gagarin into space in April 1961, the United States was way behind in the exploration of space, and being second in space meant being second in everything. And so there is a determination made by the Kennedy administration to really jumpstart that space program. And as much as anything, there was not a real clear understanding in the United States exactly what the end game was for the Soviet Union. They had launched a man-made satellite, then they had put a human into space. What were they going to do? And we didn't know that. Were they aimed towards friendly exploration and scientific purposes, or potentially could this be weaponized? There's real fear about that, that they are going to get so far ahead of us that who knows what the outcome is going to be. And so, for Kennedy in particular, we could play catch up. We could then try to duplicate everything that they had done, put a man into space and so forth, or we could completely change the nature of the game. And that's what Kennedy decides to do in 1961, is call for a moon landing by the end of the decade, which, as I said before, was audacious to the extreme because really, we weren't anywhere near that scientifically, technologically. And for Kennedy, not only would this completely orient or reorient the space race, because now all of a sudden, everything we did had leapfrogged the Soviets. And for Kennedy, I think he believed that this would be the crowning achievement of his second term. That in getting to the moon by the end of the decade, what he hoped to do was get to the moon by the time he left office. And of course, that doesn't happen. And so if you look at the moon landings, beginning in the early 1960s, there are three clear stages to that. There's the Mercury program, which actually began in the late 50s. But there's the Mercury program in the early 1960s, which is designed to get a man into space. And then by the middle part of the decade, the Gemini program is to build on that foundation, get a man outside of a spacecraft, prolong space travel, and ultimately learn how to dock spaceships together. And then the Apollo missions are to land on the moon. So you can't really take the Apollo mission in isolation. This was really a decade-long research and development program, not only in propulsion, but communication and telemetry, in computing. And each of these stages was designed to get us that much closer to the moon. For the general public, who didn't see the politics of this, the moon landing was the crowning achievement of really an 8-year televised rocket ride, beginning with Mercury and concluding with Apollo, all of which was narrated by Walter Cronkite. It started in black and white without actual live footage. They used models of the spacecrafts that they would show in studio. But by the end of the decade, they had satellite imagery, television had moved to color, and they were even able to televise the splashdowns. So for most people who got caught up in the majesty of Apollo, this had been coming for a long time.
It speaks to, you know, some of the impracticality some folks bring up about going to the moon, of course, how radical of an idea it is. And we remember it with the idealism and the majesty of it. And of course, that could play into the competition that was going on between the two nations. But how much of it was simply to get a leg up on the Soviets or to outdo them in order to try to keep them, I guess, trying to catch up?
Sure. When Kennedy first addresses a joint session of Congress in early 1961 and makes this announcement, we're gonna go to the moon, and then he follows that up the next year in 1962 with a speech at Rice University. And in the Rice speech in particular, he articulates in a very Kennedy-esque way why we're going to the moon. We don't choose to do this because it's easy. We do this because it's hard. Why did people climb Mount Everest? We did it because it was there. And he kind of positions the moon landings in this grand narrative of who we are as Americans. We fix things. We build things. We improve things. We are explorers. And so the moon landing is just the most recent example of that. But you hit the nail right on the head. Underlining that is the Cold War context. Because like I said, being second to the Soviets in space means being second to them in everything. And that's unacceptable. And you'd ask earlier about the politics. Kennedy is certainly the visionary there. But Lyndon Johnson, as much as he becomes absorbed with the Great Society and then, of course, Vietnam, he's kind of a space buff. He likes it. He's intrigued by it. I think he's intoxicated by it. And he certainly, as president, continues that. Nixon, while intrigued by it, is not as focused and doesn't play as hands-on a role as certainly Kennedy and Johnson had done earlier in the decade.
And what immediate effects do we see on society? Just the social aspect of it, what kind of response here at home do we see?
Well, it's an incredibly collective event in a way that it's difficult, I think, now to fully comprehend. Not only the United States, but it's as if a great chunk of humanity paused on July 20th, 1969. And there was a sense, not only here in the United States, but worldwide, that it wasn't just the United States going to the moon. It certainly wasn't just Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin and Michael Collins that were there, but we're all going to the moon. And Kennedy had originally believed that this would be a global effort, that the United States would cooperate with other countries. We reached out to the Soviets. They weren't receptive to that. But there were other countries that helped us tremendously with tracking the Mercury and Gemini and Apollo flights in Spain and in Australia. A lot of the technology came from other countries, certainly the communication. But there was a feeling early on that this was mankind doing this. It was the United States more specifically, but mankind more generally. And that wasn't lost on Gene Roddenberry when he first pitches the idea for Star Trek. And if you think about the makeup of the Enterprise, it's very multi-ethnic, very multinational. And certainly by the time Star Trek debuted in 1966, we were well into the Mercury program, but it hit syndication in large numbers in 1969. So that spirit is still certainly there. But there's, again, I don't know if there has been another moment that captivated people's imaginations globally the way the Apollo landing did. And there is a sense of ownership all over the world that we have reached the seminal point. For us here in the Midwest, the moon landing itself, Apollo 11 took off on the 16th of July. So we're following it. Everyone's following it. Everybody knows that this is the final step in this. Apollo 1, of course, had blown up on the launch pad in 1967. The next several Apollo missions were unmanned. But beginning in late 68 and throughout early 1969, there had been several Apollo missions, Apollo 7, 8, 9, and then 10. But as the world just kind of collectively held its breath to see this being done, it took place for us at night. It was, you know, past bedtime for kids, but we got to stay up and watch.
And now, obviously, when it comes to driving this initiative, there are more things that play in than, per se, just the president, of course. How much of this was a bipartisan deal in order to get, I guess, budgets passed, things like that, things coordinated to be able to prompt NASA into space?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think we've lost sight of the fact in the warm afterglow of Apollo 11 that the space program wasn't always politically very popular. I think Gallup showed in the early 60s that like a third of the nation supported it. And the reasoning was, we're going to spend billions of dollars. We're probably going to lose to the Soviets anyway. And that's just going to waste more money, waste more time, waste more resources, and it's going to end in more humiliation. And, you know, at least initially, there was a real skepticism that this was just a government moondoggle, that just like every other inefficient bureaucratic initiative, this is going to be mismanaged and it's not going to really produce much of a net gain. I think as much as anything, Kennedy's assassination solidifies the fact that, no, this is Kennedy's legacy, and it certainly did at NASA. I talked to an astronaut, a shuttle-era astronaut, specifically about this several years ago, and she said that within the culture of NASA, after Kennedy's assassination, any lingering doubt they had about whether or not this was actually feasible, and there was concern that maybe this just wasn't possible, certainly within the time frame. But she said that was completely gone after the assassination. NASA is going to do this. But like I said, for Lyndon Johnson, who is a true believer in space, and Johnson, you know, love him or hate him, whatever you think of LBJ, he's a pure politician. He's a, you know, has a real handle for how things get done in Washington, D.C., and he made sure that NASA was funded at the level necessary. So, you know, by Johnson's time in particular, most of that lingering doubt was gone, and people were buying in. And as far as the partisan infighting, it doesn't transcend politics, but it was certainly something that took on a momentum of its own.
Were there any things that were motivating them? One thing I personally hear at some point is that, why bother going into space? We've got enough issues here on Earth.
Sure.
That sort of thing. Was that present in the 60s?
Oh, definitely. And like I said, these are really troubling times for the United States. We have critical issues, and critical issues that are going to come to define us as a people. I guess the easiest way to understand the 60s is we're killing ourselves to save our soul, essentially. And for people who were skeptical of the moon landings, that was the primary argument. Certainly Lyndon Johnson's war on poverty, his Great Society, which was never funded anywhere near the level that Johnson envisioned, people thought that would be a much, much more efficient and much more useful use of our resources to fight poverty, to, you know, to fight all of these, you know, or to correct all these issues that are still lingering: infrastructure, highways, you know, electrical grids, things of that nature, you know, urban blight, urban decay, and so forth. Yeah, a lot of people believed that we had plenty of problems here, that this was an adventure, and it just wasn't worth it. But like I said, once 1969 rolled around, much of that was lost in just the wonder, just the awe, the romance of Apollo 11.
With movies like Hidden Figures and such, and other things like that, and, well, of course, continual historical way of looking back and trying to dig more into the past. Are there a lot of unsung heroes or unsung drivers of the space race?
You know, I think that we are getting a better handle for that, to kind of tease that out. One thing that the Gemini program did in particular is that it really tested NASA's ability to problem solve, to be faced with issues and to address them on the fly. And so by the time the Apollo missions come around, and Apollo 13, of course, is a perfect example of this, NASA had almost a decade under their belt of being able to troubleshoot and to work under pressure. And it's not just any one person. It's, again, a collective effort. And I think as the years go by, we will continue to hear stories of people that, for whatever reasons, had been overlooked by John Glenn, by Alan Shepard, by Buzz Aldrin, by Neil Armstrong, and so forth. You know, I always thought, as far as unsung heroes, of course, I mean, of the three Apollo 11 astronauts, you've got Michael Collins that stays behind on the command module while Buzz Aldrin and Neil Armstrong make this giant leap for mankind. And I've always thought, and I've read Michael Collins' book, and he seems to have, you know, in a very, you know, stoic military way, that's not a problem. This, you know, he made his peace with that. But even as a kid, I thought, wow, to have been that close to go to the moon and to have had to stay behind on the command module. So that story always fascinated me. For a personal aspect of this, to actually be in space, I was a kid during this, and so I was captivated by the science fiction of it. But, you know, for instance, when Apollo 8 circles the dark side of the moon, this is something that, you know, man had never seen before. And apparently, according to the astronauts, the stars are maybe not as bright as you would imagine in space, except for Venus, which apparently is absurdly bright in space, but they don't twinkle. And that caught astronauts by surprise, at least initially. To see the Earth rise over the moon in Apollo 8, again, those are images that no human being had ever seen. There is a debate amongst the astronauts on Apollo 8 and Apollo 10 what color the moon is, because Apollo 8 reported that it seemed to be a grayish-blue color. Apollo 10 said, no, it's brown. And the astronauts on Apollo 11 kind of settled that and said, well, it's both. It depends on where you're at. It depends where the sun is. And much of the light that's on the surface of the moon is reflected from the Earth, Earthshine. And again, they didn't know these things. But, you know, that part of it always captivated me. But at the end of the day, there were a number of men, I think four, that eventually walked on the surface of the moon before the end of the decade, and 12 in total. And Alan Shepard, one of the original Mercury astronauts, played golf on the moon. So that's pretty cool.
So did you have any memories of the actual landing?
The Apollo missions in particular, the landing, I was quite small and remember it very, very vaguely. I was more caught up in the other Apollo missions. There are six more trips to the moon after Apollo 11. Apollo 17 finally left in December of 1972, I believe. And so for me personally, I remember spending many, many summer nights with my little JCPenney's telescope out there watching the moon, completely certain that I would see them, that I would see the lunar rover, the little space buggy that's still there, as a matter of a fact, that I would see the flags and so forth. I never did, but I spent a long, long time and as a little kid looking for those.